The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. From The Economist first, May 5th, Orthodoxy and Capitalism. In religion and economics, cause and effect are hard to prove. Linking Eastern Christianity with politics and economics. Religious determinism, or the idea that particular forms of belief and worship lead to particular forms of political and economic behavior, is always a fascinating field for dabbling. Indeed, one might even say that such determinism is itself a form of religion, if that is defined as a system of thought which offers compelling answers to questions that might otherwise be shadowy and elusive. Recently, there has been a little wave of discussion about religious determinism in the E-Commentariat. It began with a working paper for the World Bank by two economists with Bulgarian roots, the country's former finance minister, Simeon Jankov, and Elena Nikolova of University College London. They crunched some of the results of two transnational investigations into social attitudes, the World Values Survey, and a probe by the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Their conclusion was that something about Eastern Orthodox Christianity had made its adherents more susceptible to communism and less oriented toward liberal Western capitalism than other people. They found that, quote, Eastern Orthodox believers are less happy compared with Catholics and Protestants, according to data from more than 100 countries. Relative to Catholics, Protestants, and non-believers, those of the Eastern Orthodox religion have less social capital and prefer old ideas and safe jobs. Compared with non-believers and Orthodox adherents, Catholics and Protestants are less likely to agree that government ownership is a good thing, and Protestants are more likely to agree that getting rich can only happen at the expense of others. Leonid Brzezinski, a Berlin-based commentator for Bloomberg News Service who lived through Russia's transition, responded that 20 years ago he would have been skeptical of such a thesis, but now he found it hard to disagree with, at least as it applied to Russia. Indeed, he noted, the economist's view chimed with an important strain in Russian thought, dating from the 19th century, which found that orthodoxy, for better or worse, created a barrier between Russia and the legal and rational order which prevailed farther west. As Mr. Brzezinski put it, the ancient roots and religious underpinnings of a culture may indeed have a greater impact on the path a country takes than any rational geopolitical or economic considerations. If so, nations with an Orthodox background aren't really comfortable in a Western-dominated world, a source of tension that can only be mitigated and never removed. This drew a response from Nathaniel Wood, Associate Director of the Orthodox Christian Studies Center at America's Fordham University. He retorted that Mr. Brzezinski was dealing in half-truths at best, and in any case relying on a stereotypical dichotomy between East and West. Such a crude dichotomy could also be found in some hard-line Russian quarters. But the best Russian Orthodox thinkers had something more subtle to propose. Quote, rather than deference to Western capitalism, which is what Brzezinski seems to want, thinkers like Sergei Bulgakov and Nikolai Berdyaev point toward the possibility and necessity of Orthodox theological engagement with Western thought. Such engagement serves as a reminder that orthodoxy need not be opposed to every aspect of modern Western economics, but that Christianity should not simply be capitalism's handmaid either. As this discussion suggests, the religious determinist theories are easy to propose and also relatively easy to undercut because they can be challenged by a few robust counterexamples. Consider the fact that all over the Ottoman Empire, from Turkey to the Levant, the segment of society that showed the strongest orientation toward capitalism was precisely the Orthodox Christian minority. When members of these communities migrated to the New World, they retained their faith, their entrepreneurial skills, and several other things which the World Bank writers deem relatively incompatible with orthodoxy. Social capital, derived from strong loyalties to the extended family and voluntary forms of association, and the ability to calculate, bargain, and thrive in a diverse, law-based society. It's hard to make valid generalizations that apply both to Russia, where active adherence to and real knowledge of the Orthodox faith is confined to a small minority, and mainly Orthodox Romania, where levels of church-going and religious knowledge are much higher. If the World Bank paper has any substance, harder still to make sense of the fact that Romania's elected leaders have firmly anchored the country in both NATO and the European Union. And from the Religion News Service now of May 4th, hoping to avert a schism, the United Methodist Bishops are proposing to allow LGBT clergy and same-sex marriages. The bishops of the United Methodist Church have endorsed a plan that would allow individual pastors and regional bodies to make their own decisions on whether to perform same-sex weddings and to ordain LGBT people as clergy. The Council of Bishops recommended the One Church plan on Friday after nearly a week of meetings in Chicago, according to a council press release. The council's prayerful deliberation reflected the diversity of the global denomination on the matter of homosexuality and many other matters, said Bishop Ken Carter, president of the Council of Bishops. The council affirms the strength of this diversity and our commitment to maintaining the unity of the church. Differing views on the inclusion of LGBT members have roiled the second largest Protestant denomination in the United States, drawing to a stalemate at a contentious meeting of global delegates at the 2016 General Conference in Portland, Oregon. Bishops there announced the creation of a 32-member commission that would make recommendations to settle questions of ordination and marriage at a special session of the General Conference to be held in February in St. Louis. Carter was one of the moderators of that commission. The denomination's rulebook, the Book of Discipline, says that the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching, and, quote, self-avowed practicing homosexuals cannot be ordained as ministers, appointed to serve or married in the church. But since the 2016 meeting, many of its smaller U.S. jurisdictions and regional bodies called annual conferences have made their own decisions regarding LGBT clergy. Last year, the Mountain Sky Conference elected Karen Oliveto, a married lesbian, as the denomination's first openly LGBT bishop. For more than 20 years, individual pastors have publicly or secretly celebrated same-sex unions and, more recently, legal weddings. Several were tried in church courts and some stripped of their ordination credentials. The One Church plan is one of three proposed by the commission. Others include the Traditionalist plan and the Connectional Conference plan. Bishops will submit a report to the special session, including all three plans, and a narrative of the council's discernment process regarding those plans, but they will recommend the One Church plan. In their release, bishops said that each plan, quote, held values that are important to the life and work of the church. The One Church plan would remove the controversial language about human sexuality from the Book of Discipline, according to the council. It would also safeguard pastors and conferences who are unwilling to perform same-sex weddings or to ordain LGBT people because of their theological convictions. Few details about the plan will be available until July 8th, by which date the full report for General Conference delegates is expected to be released, according to the council. And from the Associated Press now of May 4th, Franklin Graham Books shares lessons from America's pastor. Before the 2016 elections, Billy Graham's son went to the evangelist's mountain home seeking advice before a 50-state tour to pray with Christian voters. In his new book, Through My Father's Eyes, Franklin Graham recounts that his father had concerns. Billy Graham had become known as America's pastor by advising presidents of both parties, from Dwight Eisenhower to George W. Bush. Would his son, coming into his own as a more partisan evangelical, be taking sides? He was concerned that because it was a political year and that, Franklin, you don't want to be seen as political, the son said in an interview. And that's why I went out of my way to make sure that this was a prayer rally, and I made sure I did not tell anyone how to vote. The younger Graham pointedly avoided endorsing candidate Donald Trump, but neither did he abandon him, as other evangelicals did in response to scandals that have surfaced during the campaign. He has since become an outspoken Trump ally and writes in the book that he thanks God the Republican was elected. As the leader of his father's namesake association and the Samaritan's Purse charity, Graham has been more in the spotlight since his father's death in February at age 99. It's a sensitive time for American Christians. While some evangelicals support Republicans without question, others struggle to find support in the Bible for what Trump says and does. Graham acknowledges both conservative Christians and a wider audience in his book, which intersperses his views on religion, culture, and Trump with quotes from his father and family anecdotes. I started by just looking at the things that I have learned from my father that I thought I could pass on to others that would help them in their lives, Graham explained. Each chapter starts with a Billy Graham quote, and there are poignant stories about their relationship, from the father's admonishment against playing with matches to his advice to a son committing his life to Jesus at 22. Others are laugh-out-loud funny, such as when Franklin Graham's mother, Ruth Graham, spotted, quote, a most ridiculous-looking man walking down a beach wearing loud shorts, black socks, and hush puppy shoes. As he grew closer, she gasped, oh no, it's my husband. But Graham, now 65, doesn't hold back his own views. He writes that while Republicans shouldn't take Christian voters for granted, the progressives have infiltrated our schools, our government, and our nation. Progressivism is nothing more than godless secularism, and it has stormed through the gates of America's bulwark. And in a page-long condemnation of sex and vulgar language on television, he writes, freedom of speech has evolved into a massive monster. While Graham is ostensibly referring to racy shows and advertisements, the pronouncement is open to multiple interpretations, said Bill Leonard, professor of Baptist studies at Wake Forest University. The country and the Christian community in the U.S. is so divided that there will be some who will read him and think he's trying to put words into his father's mouth. But then there will be others who say Franklin is standing in the footsteps of his father. Asked how he squares his book, Admonishments Against Profanity and Pornography, with his defense of Trump, who has been accused of sexually harassing women and trying to cover up an affair with a porn star, Graham gave a measured answer. Quote, on this thing with Stormy Daniels and so forth, that stuff happened 12 years ago. This isn't behavior that has taken place since he's been president. These things happened long before he became president. That doesn't make it right, and I don't defend those kinds of relationships he had. But the country knew the kind of person he was back then, and they still made the decision to make him the president of the United States. As for his criticism of progressives, he says he's not trying to align with either party. Unfortunately, this progressive movement is more prevalent right now in the Democratic Party, but it's also in the Republican Party, and it's growing. And this is a very dangerous thing, he said. I was a Republican and I went independent. I just got sick of all of them and I didn't want to be beholden to any group. Eschewing party labels would likely have pleased the Father Graham, describes as a humble man who wanted to keep the focus on God. Some have started working to place a statue of him in the Capitol, while others are petitioning for a Billy Graham holiday. And my father would have said, this is too much Billy Graham. He wouldn't have liked it, Graham said. There was discussion at one point about taking his name off the name of the organization. He didn't like it being called the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. He didn't want people talking about Billy Graham. And this is one of the things in the book that I want to try to get people to understand. My father wanted his life to be about God. And now from Fox News of May 5th. Saudi Arabia has reportedly agreed to a historic deal with the Vatican to build Christian churches in the kingdom, a potentially stunning development for the country that's home to Islam's holiest site, and Middle Eastern media is reporting this. The move would continue the nation's effort to transition to a moderate Islam. Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdel Karim Al-Issa of the Muslim World League and Cardinal Jean-Louis Touraine, president of the Vatican's Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, allegedly signed the agreement on April 14th, according to the Egyptian Independent newspaper. Under the agreement, a joint committee with representatives from both parties will be established to organize future meetings, which will alternate between Rome and a city chosen by the Islamic World League. During my meetings, I insisted very much that Christians and non-Muslims are spoken of well in schools, and they are never considered second-class citizens, Tehran said, told the Vatican News, adding that he believes Saudi authorities wanted, quote, to show that even in Saudi Arabia there is a possibility of discussion, and therefore of changing the country's image. Tehran's trip was also the first time the Saudi king met with such a high-profile official from the Vatican. Inspired by the religious rigorous doctrine of Wahhabism, Saudi Arabia is the only country in the region that bans the building of churches and all forms of open Christian worship. Home to Islam's holiest sites, Mecca and Medina, the move would no doubt spark outrage among Islamic hardliners. But the Vatican has urged the country to build Christian churches since a large number of foreign workers who identify as Christian are now forced to cross the border to find places where they can worship. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has been pushing a reform agenda called Vision 2030, aimed at weaning the country off of oil and introducing social changes, such as permitting public concerts, building movie theaters, and allowing women to drive. And back to The Economist now of May 3rd. Balancing acts. A court ruling makes it harder for faith-based employers to discriminate. This is a curb on religious employers' right to do so. It's a problem that arises in every liberal democracy that upholds liberty of belief, and therefore the freedom of religious bodies to manage their own affairs, while also aiming to defend citizens, including job seekers, from unfair discrimination. As a result of their entitlement to run their own show, faith groups often claim some exemption from equality laws when they're recruiting people. To take an extreme case, it would run counter to common sense if a church were judicially obliged to appoint a militant atheist as a priest, even if that candidate was well qualified on paper. But how generous should these exceptions be? In recent years, some decisions by the American Supreme Court and the European Court of Human Rights have been pretty kind, as many people would see things, to religious employers. In 2012, a teacher laid off from a school linked to a Lutheran church in Michigan lost her unfair dismissal case on the grounds that she was technically a minister, and her bosses were therefore exempt from equality laws. And in 2014, the ECHR, vindicated the Spanish Catholic Church after it effectively ended the teaching career of a priest who had married and joined a campaign against clerical celibacy rules. The ECHR is an organ of the 47-nation Council of Europe and reinforces its Convention on Human Rights. But this month, a ruling by the European Court of Justice, which adjudicates the law of the 28-nation European Union, tilted in the other direction. It issued a pronouncement that will make it harder for faith-affiliated bodies, such as charities or colleges, to favor their own adherents, at least when hiring for jobs of a fairly secular type. The latest case arose because a German woman who happens to be a well-qualified expert on human rights and equality was offered no interview when she applied for a post with a Protestant-affiliated NGO. That's a non-governmental organization. On the face of things, she was cut out for the job, which involved writing a report on Germany's compliance with the UN Convention on Racism. But she failed to meet one of the specifications, that the candidate must belong either to Germany's powerful evangelical Lutheran church, or at least to one of the denominations in a certain association of churches. Vera Eggenberger, who adheres to no church, felt the requirement was unreasonable and complained to her country's federal labor court. The court, in turn, felt torn between two almost irreconcilable legal norms, the religious freedom laid down in Germany's constitution and laws, and the equality directives of the EU. So the German court turned to the ECJ for help. The ECJ's response, delivered in Luxembourg on April 17th, came as quite a jolt for law and religion buffs. It broadly implied that Germany's national law was too generous to religiously affiliated employers, which control more than 1 million jobs in the country. The law virtually allows faith-minded bosses to decide for themselves which posts carry an occupational requirement, which is so strong that the ethos of their religion would be compromised if a person of different beliefs were hired. Through this tangle of dense legal language, the ECJ opined that this national law made things excessively easy for religious recruiters. Any claim of an occupational requirement should be just subject to judicial challenge, and the onus was generally on the employer to show why it was objectively necessary to impose a faith test, in the ECJ's view. It added that German courts should do their best to abide both by national law and that of the EU, but if it proved impossible, they should adhere to the latter. As was noted by Marco Ventura, a canon law professor and fellow of Italy's Bruno Kessler Foundation, the ruling deals a blow to religious organizations which had looked for a safe haven from pan-European equality norms. The faith groups have placed their hopes on Article 17 of the EU's founding treaty, which recognizes the reality that different member countries have different religious regimes and pledges not to interfere. But the newly issued ruling stresses that some other very important axioms are at stake. For example, Article 21 of the EU's Charter of Fundamental Rights, which bars discrimination on grounds of gender, race, religion, or sexual orientation. As Mr. Ventura adds, religious groups in Western countries have up to now managed to carve out an area of exemption by convincing some judges that devoting one's life to a faith-based institution is not employment in the usual sense, but rather a kind of disinterested vocation. That helps to explain why the ECHR vindicated the Romanian Orthodox Church in its refusal to recognize a priest's trade union. Vocation may be an accurate description for some people who feel a deep impulse to profess and live out a certain faith, but as the new ruling implies, this idea should not be abused to make millions of more or less worldly jobs involving, say, clerical work, subject to a faith test. And from the Christian Science Monitor now of May 5th, like many people, the Reverend Patrick Dubois, in 2014, had never heard of the Yazidis, the ethnic religious minority being decimated by the Islamic State, or ISIS, in northern Iraq. At the time, his gaze was still fixed closer to home. For more than a decade, this French Roman Catholic priest had been documenting the mass graves left by Nazi firing squads in the forests and fields of Eastern Europe. His work not only has garnered the gratitude of Jewish communities around the globe and France's highest honor, the National Order of the Legion of Honor, but unwittingly also turned him into a leading expert in methods of genocide. He received an email from a Jewish donor in New York in 2014, just as the assault on the Yazidis was at its height. He said, "Father, I'd love to support you for the past, but I prefer you take care of the genocide of the present," Father Dubois recalls. "When I received this email, it opened completely my eyes. It's true. Today there are mass shootings, and we don't care. So is it because a guy is not killed by the Nazis that he has no import?" Dubois followed the news as Yazidis fled the jihadists of the Middle East. He knew Pope Francis was praying for them. He prayed. But in the end, he made the decision to go himself. "I said, I will not watch the TV. I will not issue a communique. I will not make a Facebook page because people don't care," says Dubois in the offices of Yazidi Unum, his humanitarian organization based in Greater Paris. With that decision, Dubois has deepened his commitment to historical truth and to those persecuted because of their religion, whatever faith they may be. His decision comes amid a wave of anti-Semitism at home and religion-inspired killing in the Middle East. Dubois is fighting to ensure that mass killings are not only prosecuted by authorities, but also condemned by all of society. He shared thoughts about his mission less than 48 hours after returning from his most recent trip to refugee camps in Iraq. "If a French priest seems out of place in a modern civil war, consider that his path there began during World War II. His grandfather, a French soldier, was deported to the Nazi camp Ravaruska in Ukraine. He survived, but refused to discuss the details, only driving Dubois to want to know more." When Dubois arrived in 2002 at the site of his grandfather's imprisonment, the mayor there said he didn't know anything about what happened to the Jews and others. And Dubois refused to settle for that answer. He kept returning until a new mayor took him to the site of a mass grave, and he found 50 farmers who talked for the first time. He wanted to know everything about the lives of victims and witnesses alike during the war. When villagers harvested their potatoes, where they slept in their homes, how they celebrated their holidays, and, of course, how Jews were shot, and who was hired to kill them, dig their graves, and then fill them in. "These people were ready to speak," he says. It could have been finished that day, but when I came back to the car, the mayor told me what I did for one village, I could do for 100 villages, and that for me was like God's call. Since then, he and his team have visited not just 100 villages, but more than 2,000 sites across 8 countries in Eastern Europe. Acting as part historian, part detective, they have painstakingly recreated a crime scene between 1.5 million and 2 million Jews and Roma were shot and buried, that until then had been overshadowed by murder in Nazi extermination camps. On a recent Friday afternoon, Sun filled the offices of Yahad in Unum, which is a combination of Hebrew and Latin meaning together in one. Katerina Dusenko, a Ukrainian who has worked with the priest since 2010 as an interpreter, is now managing an interactive map by which users, if they know when and where families were killed, can find events surrounding the execution. There's testimony when available and geographical and historical data. Ms. Dusenko says people are still desperate for this information all these years later, but the organization's work serves not just to bring peace to victims' families. As a Ukrainian, to know my history and know what happened and accept that Ukrainians participated makes me move forward and do better things in the future and prevent the same thing from happening here. What Father Patrick does is important for Ukrainians, Lithuanians, Poles, Jewish and non-Jewish people. When Dubard decided to pack his bags for Iraq, he realized that dealing with a genocide of the present required new methods. He made a crucial link at a barbershop in Brussels. The hairdresser was a Yazidi, and his father was teaching English in refugee camps in Iraq. Now the hairdresser works full-time with Dubois as they interview the Yazidis who survived. The early interviews were difficult. They weren't talking to witnesses of crimes committed decades ago, but to victims themselves, still terrorized. The first time it was only men conducting interviews, we realized we had made a mistake. We couldn't interview women with a troop of men. Now they employ Yazidi women in the camps as they set out to understand ISIS methods, how the militant group came into villages and put up checkpoints, forced them to convert to Islam, raped the women, and indoctrinated the youths so that they believed they were children of the caliphate. More than 5,000 Yazidis were killed after ISIS took over the town of Sinjar in August 2014, and as many as 7,000 women and girls were rounded up to work as sex slaves. The United Nations has ruled that ISIS tactics amount to genocide. Dubois has documented this in his book, The Terrorist Factory, which is to be released this summer. He also wrote a book called The Holocaust by Bullets. "We try to know the topography of the crime," he says. "Such details are crucial in getting beyond labels and religious slogans. Attributing crimes to the brand Hitler," he says, "minimizes the responsibility of the individual killer, and the same is true of Islamic terrorists today. Terrorists are first criminals. They kill innocent people in the name of religion, in the name of God, in the name of power, but in the end, they're killers." Well, that's all the time we have for religion in the news today. This has been Michael Blakely. I'll talk to you later.